Here I am. Joel Garreau is my guest, and Joel is a fascinating guy. He's obviously done his homework. Many times when you interview a reporter, and he's not just a reporter, he's a reporter and editor, both at the Washington Post and much more, you don't really get into the meat of the subject because, well, reporters are reporters, and when you ask them about details of what it is they're actually talking about when they come to do a radio show, they don't know the details. Well, Joel not only knows them, but has thought very, very hard about it, obviously, and is doing a very credible job of talking to us about what we might be. Radical Evolution, his book, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. What It Means to Be Human. I'll get that right. In a moment, we'll get back to Joel and this mouse pox thing. Stay right where you are. Joel, you're an obvious exception. I almost gave up having journalists on the program because a lot of times they would write about fascinating things, but then when you interviewed them and you got into depth with them and would ask them a question, they couldn't answer it. They say, well, I just, you know, I talk to the people and report on it, but I can't explain that to you. And that would be sort of the dead end of most of the subjects we pursued. That's not the case with you. So, mouse pox, I don't quite get this one. They killed all the mice in the experiment in the lab, then didn't turn it loose in the wild to kill all the mice in Australia, but instead put it on the internet. So that's confusing.
Well, this is, you know, at the heart of the hell scenario, which is that, you know, when you're talking about technologies that can create more of themselves, like a virus can, you have to know where the off switch is. Because if you don't, very bad things can happen. The least mature of the four technologies that I'm looking at, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnology, is nanotechnology. And, you know, that probably won't be mature for another 10 years or so, but the implications of it are profound. Nanotechnology is the ability to create anything you want, one molecule at a time or one atom at a time. Anything you want. I mean, a molecularly accurate steak, if you want to, or diamonds. Well, one of the early applications of this that people are hoping for is something called nanobots. These are incredibly small robots, smaller than a human red blood cell. And what they hope, the reason they think this is a big deal is that they can imagine injecting thousands of these into your bloodstream. And first, they will be used as disease detectors, sniffing out cancer cells, for example. And then they hope that they'll be able to create attack bots, which will go out and, you know, eat the cells that you don't want, like the cancer cells, like a Pac-Man game. Mm. Well, you know, I mean, this has tremendous upside implications. That's the heaven scenario. But the concern is that in order to create, you know, enough of these robots to do you any good, the first nanobot that you build is going to have to build a second nanobot. And then those two are going to have to build another two, so you get four, and then eight, and then 16. Well, you can see how this curve goes up, and you can, you know, imagine zillions of nanobots then proceeding to self-replicate. Whenever you're talking about a self-replicating anything, whether it's a computer virus or a nanobot, you better know where the off switch is, because if you don't, you know, there's a scenario that is called the gray goo scenario.
Yes, I'm very familiar with it.
This is the one in which, you know, hypothetically, if you don't know where the off switch is on these tiny robots, then they can keep on going until there is no energy left on the entire planet, and the whole planet is reduced to gray goo. Now, there's a lot of reason to think that that may, you know, that probably is not technologically possible because there are all sorts of barriers to this in terms of physics. But the concern is that, you know, that you don't just let this stuff into the wild if you don't know, you know, if you know, where the off switch is and everything that it's capable of. But the thing is that, you know, those are only two scenarios in the heaven and hell scenario, but they're both credible. They could happen. You know, they are realistic. But there's a third scenario, which is the one that I'm pulling for, and that's prevail. And the prevail scenario is not some middle ground between heaven and hell. It's way off in its own special territory. Because in the prevail scenario, people say, hey, wait a minute, you know, all of this curve of exponential change and all of this technology going, you know, at incredible speeds. Well, the question, what is this going to do to humans? Well, the assumption in both the heaven and the hell scenario is that our futures are techno-determinist. And what that means is that this is a view of history that suggests that, you know, technology runs us rather than the other way around. And in the prevail scenario, they're saying, well, wait a minute, suppose our future is not techno-determinist. Suppose that the important thing is not how many transistors that you can get to talk to each other. Suppose it's how many ornery, unpredictable, imaginative humans that you can get to talk to each other. The reason that this is, I'm guardedly optimistic about this prevail scenario rather than heaven or hell, is that we have some examples in history of how humans have already prevailed. For example, you know, you look back at the world, look at Europe in the year 1200 or thereabouts, and you can be rationally be pretty pessimistic about the future of the human race. You see plagues, you see marauding hordes, you think, you know, we're cooked. But then in 1450, all of a sudden we invent the printing press and everything changes. Then all of a sudden we've got a way of storing and sharing and distributing our ideas in a way that had never been possible before. And look what happens. First you get the Renaissance, and then you get the Enlightenment, and that leads to science itself and to the rise of democracy, and you end up with the foundations of our world today. And, you know, all of the changes that came about as a result of the printing press were beyond the imagination of any one human being or even any one country. What this was all about was, you know, a whole bunch of individuals acting in their own best interests in a bottom-up way, not in a top-down way, inventing things like that turned out to be, oh, you know, global trade, for example, or the entire scientific enterprise, or democracy. And, you know, and so the heart of the prevail scenario is that if you can demonstrate that the number of challenges that we're facing is going straight up on an exponential curve, well, if our responses socially are flat, you know, if our institutions don't respond quickly, well, then you can pretty easily see how we're going to very quickly be toast, because if the challenges are going up and our responses are flat, the distance gets taller and taller. But the heart of the prevail scenario is, suppose there are two curves. Suppose that the changes are going up on an exponential rate, but suppose our responses are, too, also going up exponentially. You know, you can see that, for example, even in 9/11. The fourth airplane, Flight 93, never makes it to its target. Why? Because the Air Force is so quick on the trigger?
Well, that's controversial, isn't it?
Well, I don't think that was the case.
I hope that what happened is that the passengers took it down. And
yeah.
I personally believe that is what occurred.
Yeah.
However, well, I wouldn't be shocked, nor would I be surprised, if it had been shot down.
Do you think that it was that it happened because the White House was so smart?
No, I'm with you here, and I hope that the social changes are progressing as quickly or keeping pace with the technology. But I'm a pessimist, and I don't think that's happening. Now, let me give you my side of the hell scenario, and that is that yes, the world has changed, but today, with science the way it is, I see mankind ending either as a result of a scientific accident or just as likely somebody who wants us dead. And the people who committed 9/11 are people who are basically saying either convert or die. And eventually, they're going to get hold of their version of mousepox or whatever in the world it is, its equivalent. And do you, for one second, Joel, think they will hesitate to essentially push the button?
Well, this is why the hell scenario is a totally credible scenario. I mean, the thing about thinking in terms of scenarios is that all three of these scenarios are plausible and logical, and they're all very different. And people keep on asking me, well, you know, which one is it? And I say, no, you don't understand. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what the future holds. I don't know anybody who does. But what I do see is that you can think systematically and rigorously and rationally about the future, and hopefully you can help make some choices. The thing about the hell scenario that's interesting is that as soon as you say something like, you know, there's a technological possibility that we could wipe out mankind tomorrow, everybody kind of nods their head and says, yeah, that's right. I mean, the hell scenario is the easiest sell in the universe. And I wonder about why that is, because, I mean, I guess we had a really rough 20th century. The thing is that, you know, when you look objectively at, you know, where we are today, you know, almost all of the cataclysm projections have turned out to be wrong. You know, back in the 1970s, we were talking about the possibility that there were going to be food riots because there was going to be starvation in the streets. And instead, what turned out to happen is that the big problem is obesity. We're living in one of the least likely scenarios the world can imagine, which is that we haven't fired a nuclear weapon in anger for 60 years. Back in the 50s, people wouldn't have given you a plug nickel for that scenario. They would have thought that that was just incredible, and yet it's the world in which we live. Now, don't get me wrong, this could all change in the next 3 minutes. But nonetheless, we have managed to prevail. We have managed to create things like game theory that got us through the Cold War. And, you know, you can ascribe that to luck, and maybe that's true. But on the other hand, what I'm interested in is, well, what's the future of human nature? And this gets to the question of, what do you mean, human nature? What does it mean to be human? And it could be that, what it means to be human is that we're the kind of species that creates our own luck. You know, just barely fast enough, but so far we've managed to prevail. And the hope is that, you know, we will continue to do so. And again, I don't want to sound like a cockeyed optimist about this. You know, the hell scenario is real. It could happen. However, you start looking around and you're seeing brand new ways of people coming together that are really pretty amazing when you think about it. I mean, look at eBay. You know, that's not just a flea market.
Right.
That's, you know, hundreds of millions of people worldwide who are coming together without any top-down hierarchy, without anybody telling them what to do, to create, you know, a global exchange mechanism that's beyond the control of any president or any Congress. Mm-hmm. You're seeing the same thing with YouTube and with MySpace. I mean, on the one hand, these are just toys and they're trivial, but on the other hand, they are a means of humans coming together to, you know, create new realities in ways that were unimaginable 10 years ago. I mean, 10 years ago, the phrase .com was brand new. You know, think of how fast that we've changed already. And that is at the heart of the prevail scenario, is can we continue to create new ways of coming up with solutions that were unimaginable 10 years or 20 years ago, you know, the same way that we've created a world now that would be hard to have believed if you were around in the year 1200.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the prevail scenario envisions a future where the world is still divided into nation states?
That's a credible scenario. That's possible. But, you know, one of the downside risks of this is that we end up with much more fundamental divisions than we have now.
That's right.
I mean, for example, you know, right now you look at the divisions that are created in the world about, you know, over race, for that matter, or religion. Well, potentially, you know, this radical evolution could create different kinds of humans. I can easily imagine that you'd end up with three kinds of humans: the enhanced, the naturals, and the rest. The enhanced would be those people who embrace these technologies for themselves and their children and grab at every chance they get. The naturals would be people who do have access to these technologies but choose not to indulge, like today's vegetarians,
sure,
for, you know, ethical reasons or emotional reasons or whatever. And then the third group would be the rest, and these are people who, either for reasons of geography or money, do not have access to these enhancements, and they envy and despise those who do. Well, that could put, those kind of divisions could put race and religion in the shade as a divider.
Doesn't
That's
all
a very,
of human,
very bad yeah, but, scenario.
Right, but doesn't all of human history teach us that that is the most likely scenario of all? If these changes that you describe, and I'm with you, I believe they are going to manifest, do arrive, then isn't that the most likely scenario, that those who have will be hated and envied and all the rest of it by those who have not, for whatever reason, economic or otherwise?
It's a credible scenario, you know, but I don't make predictions, and I can think of a lot of reasons why that might not happen. You know, for one thing, the whole idea of haves and have-nots is an industrial age, in a way of thinking. It's based on the idea of shortages, and you know that the rich get and the poor don't get. Well, look at where these technologies are in fact going right now. Take a look at cell phones. That's moving out to, you know, those are the real personal computers of our age. You know, that's our connection to the internet. And right now, there are 30 African nations with more cell phones than they have landlines. It's been 6 years since the people of the Philippines overthrew one of their tyrants using the text messaging function on their cell phone to bring hundreds of thousands of people into the street, you know, in demonstrations that got rid of one of their tyrants.
You simply, if you were here, have you ever been to the Philippines, Joel?
No, I have not.
They're ahead of us in the cell phone category. They've got G3 deployed across the entire nation. You can go to one of the most remote areas on Mindanao, for example, and have G3 and have a picture phone and see the person that you're talking to. They're years ahead of us, and you're absolutely right. It's beyond all belief what's happened here.
And it has lots of practical consequences. I mean, you have ordinary fishermen whose lives are becoming, you know, incredibly better because they don't just have to come back to their home port to sell their fish and take whatever price that they're offered by the broker there. If they get a catch, they can start making cell phone calls while they're still out to sea and find out where the best price is.
That's right.
That may not sound like much, but that really changes lives. And these technologies are getting out to the masses much faster than television or radio or refrigeration or the automobile. So there's reasons for guarded optimism that we're not looking at the have-not, you know, situation. You know, we're talking, these technologies are not controlled by the United States or by the West, for that matter. An awful lot of these are burgeoning in places like India, China, Korea, Japan, Europe. I mean, this is a global project that we humans are on, and it's unlikely to be stopped. The question is whether we will have the wisdom to come up with, you know, ways of dealing with this that are as amazing as the technologies that are advancing so rapidly.
All right, Joel, hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. There's something I want you to consider during the break, and that is the hell scenario by scientific error. I could describe many, many moments in human history where we've stumbled into or created a new technology, whether it would be Element 92 and the early nuclear testing that went on. Of course, they didn't know what was going to happen, but they plowed ahead anyway. Or an incident in San Francisco where they took away somebody's immune system to try out a new drug for the AIDS virus that had the potential to race around all of humanity and kill us. In other words, the big oops factor. We'll be right back. Joel Garreau is my guest. He's a fascinating man, no question about that. He's written a book that I suggest you pick up. If it's anything like, well, the interview has been, you're definitely going to want to read it. Radical Evolution is the name of it. The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. He's a reporter, both reporter and editor at the Washington Post. I'm Art Bell. In a moment, we'll talk about the oops factor. The big difference between the technology that was and getting up toward the top of the curve and where we are right now, Joel, is that in the past, a mistake meant a local problem or, at worst, a regional problem. But with where technology is going, particularly the technologies that you've been talking about, our very core, our genetics, or whether you're talking about little tiny machines that go raise around our body and fix heart trouble and cancer and all the rest of it, somewhere along the line here, there's going to be an oops factor. And I recall in San Francisco, they killed a guy's complete immune system trying out a new drug on him. And they admitted that there was the possibility of trouble for the entire human race if it went wrong. But it didn't stop them. They went ahead anyway. Then we go back to the invention of the bomb, and they thought, well, the whole there was credible thought that the whole atmosphere might ignite, but they went ahead and pushed the button anyway. And I could go on giving you examples, but as we get into this newer technology that you've been discussing tonight, there is the possibility of hell by mistake, isn't there? Because since when do they not push the button?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is why the hell scenario is credible. You know, it absolutely could go that way. But what I find fascinating is, why do we... I wonder if there's something about humans that we're so obsessed with the hell scenario. I mean, if you have three scenarios that are equally rational, why is... I mean, this happens to me all the time, is people always want to focus on the hell scenario.
Sure.
And I think I've given this some thought. You know, we have been projecting these hell scenarios for a long time. In 1816, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley wrote Frankenstein, and it was a huge hit. And it was she was just a teenager, and she had this amazing creative vision. And I'm wondering whether what's going on is that it's much easier for us to imagine disaster than it is to imagine solutions. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons that I started pushing towards trying to imagine, well, what would a transcendent human look like? You know, if these technologies are, in fact, pushing forward, the trouble with the people who are advocating the hell scenario, I mean, I have a great deal of respect for them. They're asking very important questions. They're asking questions like, should we eliminate pain and suffering? You know, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe, suffering and dying is a critical part of what it means to be human. I think that's a fascinating question, I'm glad we're asking these questions. I wish that we had been asking questions this smart back when we were originally sold nuclear power, for example. However, you know, when you start asking people who talk about the hell scenario, they say, "Well, what would you then do about it?" And they, you know, and that's where they kind of draw a blank. They say they kind of say, "Well, we should maybe stop it all." Well, it's unlikely. I mean, whatever problem we've got, the bigger the problem, the more likely we are to reach for a brand new technological fix. For example, the energy crisis. One of the reasons why we might survive that and, you know, move on to a world beyond oil is that it's getting more and cheaper to produce alternatives to oil, like ethanol from cellulose, from wood.
Right.
The big deal about that is that, you know, a few years ago, the enzyme that was required to create that ethanol cost the equivalent of $5 a gallon. Now it costs 15 cents a gallon, and the reason is genetic technology. We've created brand new bugs that are able to, you know, digest this wood and, in effect, turn it into gasoline. Right now, there's a company in Silicon Valley called NanoSolar, which has broken ground for its factory. I mean, it's got $100 million in venture capital funding. And what they're planning on doing is creating flexible sheets of plastic that, in effect, generate electricity. Again, that's nanotechnology at work. So the question is, you know, I think that the real stretch of imagination is not to, you know, think about how this could all, you know, go to hell tomorrow, because it quite clearly could. But the question is, well, suppose, the thing is, a pessimism doesn't take a lot of imagination. You know, anybody can think about how this could all go to heck in a handbasket tomorrow. The real challenges over the last 20 or 30 years have been ones of, to try to imagine the upside. I mean, think about IBM back in 1980. They then projected that the entire world market for PCs for the next 10 years was going to be 254,000 copies. Notice the precision. Not 250, 254. You know, and so everybody nodded their head, and they proceeded to act on this projection. And, of course, they were off by almost exactly a factor of 100. You know, if they had just had, you know, the wit to try to think about the upside, they never would have given, you know, Bill Gates the job of creating the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, AT&T back at that time, you know, decided there was no future in mobile phones. And look at where AT&T is today. You know? So I've been trying to think about, I mean, I've expended some of my energy trying to imagine, well, okay, you know, suppose this technology does, in fact, continue to increase, you know, and suppose our, you know, social responses to it manage to struggle along in our imperfect way at the same pace, you know, well, what would a transcendent human be like? And this goes back to my thing about, you know, well, what do you mean human? What do you mean human nature? And I think what we are basically is that we're storytelling, pattern-seeking animals. I think that's what humans are. We can't tolerate an absence of meaning. I mean, we will look up into the night sky and see stars, and we'll come up with the most elaborate stories as to why the stars are arranged the way they are. You know, and we'll see dragons up there and bears and dippers and kings and queens.
Yes.
Because we just can't imagine that this is random. Well, I think that one of our challenges right now, the reason that the health scenarios are so credible to us, is that we've got a problem with our narrative about how the world works. I don't think this is a technological problem. I think that this is a spiritual problem in a lot of ways, or a social problem. We just don't have, we no longer have an agreement on how the world works. And I was thinking about the last time we had a change in history as dramatic as the one that radical evolution talks about, you know, and it was the one about 1,000 years B.C., where we were increasingly becoming conscious. You know, we not just had brains that functioned, you know, allowing us to count, but we started to become self-aware. And what happened back then was that all over the world, among societies that were not in contact with each other, you know, we saw the rise of all the world's great religions. We saw the rise of the Judeo Old Testament that led to Christianity. We saw the rise of Buddhism and Confucianism. We saw the rise of the great philosophers of Greece. And I'm wondering that, and they talk about this as the axial age. You know, it's the age in which all of these new understanding systems come up. And I've begun to wonder, I wonder if we're ripe for a new axial age. I wonder if we're ripe for a new way of starting to think about what, you know, what this all adds up to. I'm not particularly religious myself, but it occurred to me to think, you know, well, you know, maybe I should be talking to some of the people who were devout, because, you know, they've been thinking about this for several thousand years. Maybe they have something to say. And I ended up talking to Karen Armstrong, who wrote this terrific book called A History of God. And, you know, and she's the one who turned me on to this axial age, where you saw Confucian, Buddha, Zarathustra, Homer and the Greeks. And what I think what we were doing back then, we were filling up the emptiness in our emerging consciousness with the highest aspirations for human nature we could possibly imagine. I think that that's what those religions are about. And I'm wondering whether it's time, you know, whether we're now heading into a situation in which, you know, we are going to be coming up with our own new narrative about what it means to be human, and whether there, you know, whether what is going to be evolving is a new narrative about who we are, how we got that way, where we're headed, and what makes us tick. Now, you know, call me a cockeyed optimist, but, you know,
well,
worked
you
the
are.
Last time. Maybe it'll work this time.
You are kind of an optimist, but that's fine. What kind of social structure, Joel, do you imagine that would support this prevail scenario?
Well, the core of it would have to be, you know, the whole idea of the transcend idea would be an elaboration of the prevail scenario. And again, the reason I'm interested in what the optimistic version might be is that the pessimistic version doesn't get you much of anywhere. You know, you just say, okay, the world's going to come to an end tomorrow. You know, it doesn't make much of a movie. There's not much plot to it. You know, it's the end of the world is at hand. There's nothing you can do about it. Hold on tight, the end, with fabulous special effects. But otherwise, it's not much of a movie. Neither is the heaven scenario for the same reason. Whereas, you know, the idea of trying to forge our own transcendence, trying to imagine, you know, what this world could be like and how we could come together, well, what that would involve is, you know, is in fact, you know, what we're seeing is this dramatic change in human connectedness that we're seeing all over the world that is enabled by our technology, is not caused by it. I mean, look at this conversation that we're having. You know, you're in the Philippines, I'm in Virginia, your producer is God only knows where. You know, and we think nothing of this. And yet this is becoming more and more common. And it's this connection with more people who are not saints, you know, who are struggling, who are coming up with good enough solutions. But the deal is that now if you find a good enough solution, you can find it worldwide, and you can implement it in a big hurry. And that's the fundamental change that was simply not possible, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Okay, but Joel, even with this connectiveness that we have, and it is amazing and it's wonderful, but until we stop killing each other and everybody, you know, holding up their version of God's book in front of them as they do so, until we stop that, and the divisions over religion, and until we move past the individual nation state, I mean, many presidents have uttered the New World Order or One World Government or however you want to look at it, that these words have come from their mouths, usually followed by much criticism. Until we get to that point, how do we even imagine the prevail scenario?
You're absolutely right. You know, I mean, once again, as I say, you know, that, you know, it could be that we're going to toast ourselves in the next, you know, 5 minutes. I don't mean to say that I don't view that as a credible scenario. However, you know, what you can see is, historically, is that an awful lot of our problems don't ever get solved. They just sound more and more antique. For example, I have two daughters who are teenagers, and, you know, on television they watch documentaries about the civil rights era, and it's like it was a million years ago. They just don't get it. They look at the people being hit with the fire hoses, and they say, what was that about? I mean, the significance of this is that problems, I don't think, ever get solved. They just end up sounding more and more antique. You know, the issue of, you know, the Cold War and communism. For my kids, that's ancient history. They barely know who Ronald Reagan is. There are, you know, and that would be that there might be a parallel evolution in history in which, you know, the idea of, you know, the nation state and one world government and all of the stuff that we talk about today just ends up sounding more and more antique because it's transcended by the new stuff that we create that we go along that we're just beginning to imagine as we go on today. I mean, it's tough. If you focus only on the past, of course you're going to be a pessimist because the solutions for our new problems don't exist back there. The issue is, can we start inventing things on the fly and sharing them ever faster? You know, and if that's, you know, Panglossian, if that's too optimistic, then we are in fact doomed. But in fact, we see some history that suggests that that's possible.
I'm trying to get in a place where I can agree with that, but I'm not sure I can. I am a pessimist, and it just seems to me that we've got to find a way around this religious divisiveness and these separate governments that I just can't even imagine. I can certainly imagine all of the technological changes that you're talking about. I can imagine very privileged, changed human beings in the U.S. and perhaps in Europe and even some parts of Asia. And then I see this world of haves and have-nots, and I just can't imagine the kind of social evolution that it's going to take for us to prevail.
Well, in which case, we're toast. The other thing, too, is that you know, I don't think that, you know, when you look historically at solving an awful lot of these problems, you know, you can't count on people to change. You can, however, count on them to die, or at least so far.
That's true.
And when they do, they're replaced by new people, younger people, who are not necessarily better or worse than the ones who preceded them, but they've had an entirely different life experience, and they've come up with an entirely different view of the future. So, you know, it's. I think that it's, I mean, I've seen it happen, you know, in my lifetime in which problems that seemed utterly intractable and utterly insoluble end up sort of fading away as younger people just can't quite remember why, you know, in the United States, why, you know, race was such a big deal, or, you know, in Canada it was language. I'm not suggesting that I think that humans are not going to be figuring out brand new ways of dividing themselves up. I mean, we're ornery, cussed, unpredictable critters, we humans, and I don't think that's going to change. You know, what I do think is that we've also got an ability to steal fire from the gods every chance we get. I mean, I think that's at the core of human nature, too. And, you know, existential threats to, you know, to our existence has a wonderful way of focusing us, you know, on the problems at hand. For example, you know, one of the reasons to be guardedly optimistic about the prevail scenario is suppose these technologies, you know, one of the reasons, you know, the things that I've been doing about this is I've been typing as fast as I can. I mean, I don't have much hope in that these solutions are going to be handed down to us by some president or by some Congress or by some, you know, collection of wise men. If we solve these problems, I have a hunch that we're going to be doing it in a bottom-up way, not top-down, where millions of individuals produce, you know, small solutions that are good enough, like eBay, like YouTube, like MySpace, and which originally start as toys, but which end up becoming something much larger than that, you know, almost while we're not looking. If we can't do it in a bottom-up way, if we can't do it, you know, millions of individuals solving their own individual problems locally and producing good enough solutions locally, then I think we're toast.
The pessimist in me says, gee, a lot of these big things are developed by who? DARPA. DARPA goes out and looks for these new ideas, new inventions, new technologies, and what do they have in mind for them?
Sure.
Not necessarily emptying the cancer wards across the world, but a better way to have war.
All of these technologies emerge first wherever there is the most competition, and that's why you see it first in the military and especially in sports.
You know, true.
I'm going to be real surprised if we don't have enhanced leagues sometime soon.
All right. Hold it right there, and we'll be right back. We're going to take a break here at the top of the hour, and then we're going to open the phones. Joel Garreau is my guest, and what a guest he is. We're talking about the future, the rather immediate future of the human race. Do you want to be part of it? Will you take that pill, or will you say, no, not me? I'm Art Bell.